You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Nick Mills. Nick is a wonderful actor. He's also a teacher. And he's a really old friend of mine from college at the University of Evansville. We met when I was 17 and a freshman, and he was a junior. We ended up doing Othello together his senior year when he played Iago and I played Desdemona. And now here we are both in our 30s, and we live in New York City for a long time. We're both parents to little babies who have met each other, and it just makes me so incredibly happy to have people in my life for that long and to see them thrive. As I said, he's a wonderful actor and a thoughtful artist, and I've already been putting into practice some of the insights that he shared with me in this conversation. You can check out what he's up to at nickmosesmills.com, and I hope you enjoy the 137th episode of The Compass. What do you do to try to keep from going to the dark side as an artist?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is go running.
So you run like marathons and stuff, right?
Yes, I've run 6 marathons.
Oh my God.
I credit Liz Vidal with turning me into a runner.
In college?
Yeah. And what I've noticed is that anything that I'm feeling, whether it's depression about my career or my family, or whatever it is, whatever that dark side, I always find that if I run, it brings me back to myself. Something about the exercise, and my mom noted too that when you're exercising, you're also breathing. Mm-hmm. And so the breath can bring you down and center you and ground you and bring you back to who you are. So that's the first thing that I would say that I do. But I've noticed as of late, though, it's kind of difficult not to go to the dark side.
Yeah.
Just recently, in general, I feel like it's coming up more and more, and I actually don't have the time to run like I normally do. So I've had to find other ways to snap myself out of it.
Are you still working on finding those ways?
Yes. those ways are still in process. I mean, it's a lot of faking it, to be honest.
Yeah. I get that.
I find that, I'm hosting this Dadcella next Friday.
Yes.
That I've invited Frankie to.
He's really excited about.
Which I'm excited about. And something I said in that invite, in that email, is I said, look, I noticed that my wife gets together with all her friends, or a lot of women, and they discuss motherhood, and they have moms groups, and they discuss breastfeeding and balancing work and motherhood. But I noticed that dads don't do that very often. So. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be nice if we all gathered and had a moment to share and talk? And selfishly, I'm really doing it so that I can hear about all of my friends' successes and possibly steal some of their tools that keep them happy. But also, the real reason is to find out if I'm insane and to find out if they too are experiencing this darkness, because
I think you're going to find that they are.
I'm hoping, and I imagine I will. But it's strange because career-wise, I find that I've been very lucky. Mm-hmm. I've done just fine. In fact, all the dreams that I had coming to New York have been accomplished in this odd way. I've been on Broadway. I've been on television. I'm good, you know. I have this beautiful wife. I have 2 beautiful children. There shouldn't be a reason that I feel down or sad, and I do. In fact, the sadness and darkness that I've been feeling as of late has been probably more intense than it ever has been. Hmm. which is surprising to me. And and something I'm still grappling with. Like, wait a minute, why would it come about now of all times?
Right. It's hard to talk about, because I feel some of that too, but it's hard to talk about when you're constantly not apologizing for it, but balancing it out with those things. But like, everything's great.
Right.
But I'm dealing with this, or everything's amazing in this section of my life, but.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That is an odd thing.
One way I try to battle it is by just practicing gratitude. And literally speaking it out loud is something I've been trying to do lately. It's like that whole idea where if you smile, it'll make you happy because the muscles in your brain are, you know, if you smile, then the endorphins are released in your brain. So lately I've just been saying it, especially in the mornings. I'm like, I'm so grateful for these two beautiful children I have. I'm so grateful for this wonderful apartment I have and this great neighborhood. And that seems to sort of knock me out of it a little bit. And I discovered the purpose of life recently.
Do tell.
I would like to share it with your listeners. Well, for me, that is the purpose of life for me. Mm-hmm. Having watched so many people succeed around me, and for many years dealing with my own jealousy and my own fear that it would never happen to me, and then slowly moving to a point where once I realized that my friend's successes were also mine. As I said to Frankie actually recently, if success were measured by the people that we keep company with, we would be the 1%.
Yeah.
Because of all the incredibly talented and fascinating, smart, joyful people that we call our friends and see on a regular basis. So when I got to the point of being like, okay, wait, I don't need to be jealous anymore. I can be thrilled and happy for people. And really got centered with that. I realized, okay, but what then does make me happy? Because I'm noticing, and I've learned too from all these successful people, the Reed Bernies of the world, the Rami Maliks of the world, that if anything, they're more unhappy when they find great success. Mm. If anything, the ceiling, the bar is raised, the goalposts are moved, and no matter what, no matter what award, no matter what artistic endeavor that they achieve, or, you know, are awarded, they're still empty. So I was like, okay, the business can never fulfill this happiness. This is nothing new to anyone, but it reiterated to me over and over again. And I was like, okay, so what is it going to be? And I find that doing, just giving to others is the thing that makes me most happy. And I actually think it is the secret to happiness of life, is pure, unadulterated giving, whether it be volunteering or making my wife eggs in the morning, having her lemon water ready when she wakes up, small things.
Yeah.
Not in a way of doing it so that you get it back, but just purely giving. And it's hard to remember. I forget it every day. I was like, oh, wait, remember you told yourself this is the secret of happiness. Just give to other people. And every other week I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot. You know, because you're like, get caught back up in the grind and the need to achieve or to prove yourself. And especially now, I think, with social media, like, it makes it very strange, because I was part of a short reading earlier this week, and I emailed the director and she didn't get back to me for 24 hours. And I was like, oh, it must have been really bad. It must have been really disappointing to her. And that's why she's not returning the email.
Right.
But I'm like, why do I even like do this to myself? Why do I even like put myself through this?
Yeah.
But I think it's just a different time. I don't know. Do you feel that way ever?
About social media?
Well, or just about this sort of need to be validated in.
Yeah. And I actually, like some of my best girlfriends from Evansville, like Lori and Kim and Polly, and I have a group text. And I had seen on the blog this illustration that was like a chart with a big circle, and it said like times I think that people are angry with me, and then like there was a close up that said like 1,000 times magnified dot of like times people are actually angry at me.
Right.
And I texted it to them, and I was just like, this is exactly how I feel all the time.
Well, and as my mom reminded me once, she's
some
like, it's
anxiety
actually,
in that. Yeah,
yeah, why? But she said, my mom said to me, like, you know, it's actually quite selfish to think that people are like going home and thinking about you.
Yeah, it is something about ego.
Yeah, of like saying, oh, everyone's thinking, oh, why did Nick say that? Or why was Nick so bad in that play or in that TV show?
But you would
and you're
never
like, wait
think
a minute.
Of it that way.
I never go home and think about, oh man, Leah was just, you know, awful and drunk with Vanya. No, it's like the complete opposite. I'm like, oh my God, she was so amazing. And most of the time, that's what I think about all my friends. They're so great. I hope I didn't offend them. I just don't know why my mind goes there or why it needs to. It's actually like a lot of wasted thought
really
when I think about it.
A
I could be doing so much more interesting things.
A lot of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to have that cycle of, you know, even if you have a glimpse of something that where you're like, oh, this is the thing, this is the key that's going to help me with this place I keep going to.
Right.
That you have to keep reminding yourself.
Yeah. Well, and it actually calls up some big questions for me because I love acting and I love this business. I still have a very strong desire to be a part of it and to be involved with it. But if I've figured out now that, like, it's actually not going to deliver in the way that I want, what does that mean? Because something about my path for me, like, I've always thought about this, and even since I was young, is that my path is going to be one of delayed attainment. Like, I never have skipped any levels. I've been an extra. I've been an understudy. I feel like I've done every step. And it's always, there's always been, like, growth, but it's been slow. And it's slow and steady and wins the race. Okay, great. It's a marathon. If it's going to quote unquote happen for me, it's going to be later in life. And so the idea of delayed attainment has always been really exciting to me because I see it as a marathon. I see it as a long, long process. But that being said, I'm wondering, like, there's not going to be a day that I arrive at and say, well, I've done it. Like in any other profession, as a doctor or as a lawyer, you can get to a certain pinnacle and you're like, I've achieved monumental success and I'm satisfied and happy. But I don't know that that day comes for an artist. And I think that's a good thing because it makes you continually strive to keep creating and finding more. But if it's not going to deliver in this way that I want to, what does that mean? What does that mean? Do I need to find something else to do?
Right.
And it's been fascinating, especially since having kids. And I would imagine this has been similar for you. Having kids has done two things for me. It's done this thing where it's completely taken the charge off of succeeding. I'm like, okay, well, if I screw up this audition or this doesn't go so well on this stupid procedural television show that I've never seen an episode of, who cares? Because I come home to this beauty and these amazing beings who completely rejuvenate me and keep me young and vital and joyous. On the flip side, it has made me more ambitious and more hungry than I've ever been because I really don't like doing anything else. I don't want to cater and I like teaching, but I really don't want to make money any other way.
Right.
And so I actually have to be more ambitious if I want to participate and contribute to my family. And so it's a very strange thing. It's like I don't care anymore and yet I care more than ever. And I just have not figured out how to reconcile that.
Well, that's the big question is when you combine art with commerce.
Right.
And that is what defines the success around it now in our society. And when you were saying like how you had always looked at your career, that it would be like delayed.
Mm-hmm.
What was the word you used?
Delayed attainment.
Delayed attainment. And I was thinking, I was like, oh, what did I always say to myself? And I guess I always said to myself that I just wanted to be able to, like, make my living as an actor.
That's exactly what I said. I never needed...
And then I was like, why would I define it that way? But then that's a perfectly justifiable way to define it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But I'm defining it by money, not by what I want to be making.
Right,
know?
Right. Well, I would say something...
Or that's the unsaid, I guess. What I want to be making is the unsaid part of that, but...
Well, I would say something similar. Like, I would always just say, I just want to live off what I love to do. I don't need to be...
I don't need
the accolades.
Making millions.
No.
But...
I think about, like, actors like Campbell Scott or I ran into this actor at the playground yesterday, Noah Emmerich, who is in Little Children, who everyone's like, oh yeah, I know that name. And he's got this very strange face, and he's been in a million things. He's always excellent, but he can walk down the street mm-hmm. and people kind of recognize him, but aren't bombarding him. I'm like, oh, I would love that life.
Yeah,
that's the ideal. But I'm sure he's also like, man, I wish I was doing more. You know, there's probably still something in him that wants more.
Right.
But I think living off what you love to do is just a perfect life.
Yeah.
It's that is the one thing with the people who have gotten to a certain point success-wise that I am jealous about. It's not the awards. It's not the, you know, being recognized. It's not having to hustle for the next gig.
Right. And not having to worry about money.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Although, I will say this. Having married a woman whose family has a lot of money, mm-hmm. whether you have it or you don't have it, there's worries around it no matter what. And there's complications around it no matter what. And that has been a big... That marrying Ashley has been the best thing of my life. But it brought up so many complications for me internally. Nothing that she brought to the table, all stuff that I have brought to the table and still do bring to the table, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Because I always had problems making money. I was always bad with it. I am bad with it. I mean, it's just true. Like, I have tons of student loan debt, tons of credit card debt. And it's not because I'm buying clothes or CDs that don't exist anymore. It's because when I'm out with friends, I pick up the tab because I want to be generous.
Right.
And as Ashley said to me recently, she's like, sometimes your generosity sets us back financially. And it was so hard to hear. And I was like, oh man, that's really tough because I'm coming from a good place.
Right.
But it's actually not helping.
Right.
And so that's been a hard pill to swallow. And it's also, you know...
And it's something that I'm sure your friends aren't expecting either.
Right. They're not expecting it at all. They don't need it.
But in the moment, it probably feels great.
It feels really good. It feels really good.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating, I think. I'm fascinated that I attracted this person who came from a lot of wealth. Her father is totally self-made. And worked his ass off and, you know, didn't come from money and now is investing completely in renewable energy and solar panels and, you know, has worked 7 days a week to make the world better. And that's all on him. And Ashley, too, you know, runs a nonprofit and has a new startup with Madri Collection for a clothing line for breastfeeding mothers. And, you know, these are very... passionate, driven people, just like me. But it's just, I find it interesting that I've sort of attracted this person who's complete opposite of me financially. And I am the one that has to really reckon myself to how to, and what was interesting for the first 3 years of our marriage was like, I was working on Broadway, I had the steady check, and now we've hit this little patch where I don't have work and I'm home with the kids. And it's tough. Frankie and I spoke about it. You know, it's a strange thing as a man, sort of this embedded caveman bullshit, if I can say that on this show,
yeah.
That makes you think that you need to be out there doing it and working and contributing in this way that's really just so archaic when it comes right down to it. But it's still in me,
mm-hmm.
you know. But the more and more I just sort of accept, like, I'm doing the best work by just being home with my kids and, like, reading to them and making sure that, especially my son, grows up in a world where he realizes that it's important to be kind and generous and that women are much smarter than us and we should let them run the world and all those things. It's a very interesting time to be a man, you know, and it's like, you know, especially raising a man. Ashley and I talk about it a lot. But maybe that's a different show. I don't know.
No, I love this show. So your daughter is two.
Two and a half.
Two and a half. And then your son is...
8 months.
8 months. 1 month younger than Sassy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a... That is an interesting task, raising a man.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, I mean, obviously we would have been completely thrilled whatever baby we had, boy or girl, but I just because I'm a woman, I guess I was slightly more inclined to feel like I knew what was happening if I had a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to remind myself that, like, oh, if we have a boy, it's going to be our boy. And it's going to be a piece of me, and it's going to be a piece of Frankie, who is this kind of man that I want to see in the world, and the one that I chose to be with, the sensitive, thoughtful, you know, warm-hearted guy, and that our son would somehow learn about those things, you know? But I you know, it's a scary time to be a man in this world. And
yeah, I mean, it's like it is
interesting to raise one.
I think we've had it really easy, you know? We were watching...
I don't know if I said that correctly. It's a scary time to negotiate raising one. I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah. Well, it's just interesting because I think at home is really where they're going to learn how to be a person.
Yeah.
And I'm not too worried about that between Ashley and I, that we're going to raise like a really sensitive, sweet, caring, empathetic, lovely man who he already is that. But it's amazing in society how ingrained it is. Something as simple as I was showing Ava Beauty and the Beast yesterday, and I was watching. I was like, oh my God, Gaston's behavior is awful. He is just disturbing.
Yes.
In how he expects this to happen. And then at the end, when the Beast is dying and Belle is standing over him being like, oh my God, she goes, it's all my fault. And I was like, wait, no, it's not. I mean, you're just doing your thing, trying to read books and get out of the town and like live your life. But why do they say, you know, that it's all the woman's fault for some reason?
Yeah.
But this has been the way it's been for a long time. And so we're in this like very wonderful opportune time to change that, ideal. It's funny with Ashley wanted a girl. Was very set on having a girl and still wants a girl. She wants Ava to have a sister.
Right. She has lots of sisters.
Right.
I'm sure.
Right. But I, even since I was a little boy, always said I want a girl first and a boy second.
Oh, wow.
And it going back to this whole idea of, you know, this thought that I keep having sometimes of like, I have everything I want. It's strange to have that thought sometimes because you realize how powerful your mind can be. You're like, okay, I want to be on Broadway. All right, you were on Broadway. I want to have a girl first. I want to have a boy second. That happened. And so then when these things happen, you start to go, okay, now what do I want? And I have not been able to answer that question yet. Mm. I don't know what the next thing is. I can say little things like, oh, I'd love to like go to the movie theater and see myself on the big screen someday, even if it was like extra read all about, like Paperboy or something like that. Just one time, just to say that would be wonderful. But I don't know what that next thing is. I'm still figuring that out. And that's a strange, scary place to live in. Of like, okay, now what?
There's also a lot of opportunity there, though. That
it could
be anything.
It could be anything. But you know how sometimes when you have so many options, how do you settle on one?
Yeah. Do you have any other artistic outlets? Have you ever been someone who writes for yourself or stuff you share with others? Or
oddly enough, after I finished NYU, when I moved to Los Angeles, and Liz Vital and I started our theater company, Vitality Productions, those 5 years out there where I was eating shit and never auditioning and working as a caterer and a driver and a bartender and a host at a fine dining restaurant, I was more artistically satisfied in those 5 years, I think, than I ever have been.
Wow.
Because we were creating stuff from the ground up. We were writing strange little pieces that we were doing at the Fringe Festival. I wrote a one-man show that I did at Ars Nova. I was emailing people our reviews, being like, get to our show. Like, this is what you need to be seeing. In L.A., you know, this theater in L.A. is so hot right now. Actually, it's gotten a lot better. But it's been fascinating to think back on that time and remember how productive I was and remember how artistically driven I was. And I don't know about what it is about getting older, being 38 now, and that was when I was 25 to 30, and I just had so much confidence and naivete about the world. Right. But I missed that. I missed that time, and I did a lot of writing then.
What was your one-man show about?
It was called Baby Talk, and it was about, this is before I had kids, it was about a man who comes home with these two twins just coming home from the hospital, and he can't, they keep crying, and they won't stop crying, and he doesn't know how to calm them, so he starts telling them stories. But also, the big question is like, so hey, where's their mom, right? And so he starts, I was fascinated with trying to bring more multimedia elements into live theatrical pieces. And so we filmed all these home videos with Bill Heck's wife, Maggie Lacey. And so he started showing the babies these videos of their absent mother. And this, it's sort of revealed during the show that they had the kids, but he always really wanted kids and she wasn't quite sure. And then somehow at the hospital, she disappeared and bolted, and he was left alone with these two children. Kind of been like an odd thing now that I'm saying it out loud, but it just gave me an excuse to be, I wanted a real reason to talk on stage by myself. I didn't want to just tell stories. I wanted to have someone to talk to, so I chose these babies. Mm-hmm. And it was great. I love writing. I find we don't really, when we're in between jobs if you've gone to a lot of school, you really don't want to go to class anymore. And a friend of mine said to me the other day that the way you practice, if you want to be an actor, the way you work the muscle is to write. And I think that's so true. Finding the time for it is hard. I've never been someone who just can be disciplined and do it every day. Mm-hmm. But when I do write, it happens very quickly and it goes really fast and tends to be really dark and strange and I never know where it's going, but I really enjoy it, and I wish I did it more. And I do like directing. I'm happy to do all the disciplines. Producing was such an enjoyable thing to do with Liz out in LA. But there's something about it now that maybe it's because that art and commerce thing of do I really want to bust my ass to do a little play somewhere for 50 people?
Well, and it's your time now, too. It's more valuable because of your kids.
Right.
Frankie and I talk about that all the time. If he's been offered to do a reading or something, and it's a week for $75, and, we're going to be spending $100 a day on babysitting or whatever it is, how is the play something he's really passionate about? If it's not, it's not worth it. How are you balancing that time?
Right.
How valuable your time is.
Right. Right. I got asked to do a reading. I was really excited. And then I read the play. And I said yes without reading the play. Because I was like, God, I just need something to work on. Uh-huh. The play was really bad. But I was happy to be in a room for a week with a great director and great actors. But it really kind of took me away from my family for 5 days in a row and didn't pay that much and didn't really fill the hole.
Right.
And so then you say, okay, so was that worth it to do? But I kind of think because we're not in it's a strange art form because especially if you go to all the school you can go to, like we've done, and you still don't get to do it every day. It's a strange thing to reconcile because you're like, everyone else goes to 10 years of medical school and then they not only get to work every day, but they get to make a bunch of money from it too.
That's something that I have not reconciled.
I
posted something recently when I paid off the student loans I had and I posted something about how thrilled I was and proud of myself and simultaneously at the very same time, how frustrated and angry I was that I had to do it mostly through other jobs that had nothing to do with my degrees.
Right. It was an amazing post. I remember reading it.
And it's just so frustrating.
Now, do you feel now that your loans are paid off, do you feel different? Is there anything?
No.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I did not have as many as some people because I had a free living situation during school. So Frankie has many more loans than I did. Mine were mostly for tuition. But
right.
It feels good to have them paid off.
Yeah.
Because even though I'm still not making money doing what I am trained for, while I was paying the loans, and not getting a chance to work as an actor, that was like a special thorn in my side.
Sure, sure. I mean, essentially, I'm just paying the interest on my loans at this point. But I wonder, like, because I try to look at it in this, like, this is denial talking right now and rationalization, because I'm like, okay, so I open up my computer and I click, and then, quote unquote, the loan is paid, right? But I see no change, you know, in my life. It just is a number that's different on the screen. And even if I'm late on the loans, it's not even a person who's calling me. It's an automated something that's calling me, right? It's like some strange voice. And so does that...
Do the loans exist?
Right. Exactly. And is anyone going home being like, oh, I got to get that money from Nick Mills. He really better pay me. No, it's like it goes to some big bank or something.
The
like,
system is so large, it's hard to even imagine.
Yeah, which is like a really easy reason just to say, I'm not going to pay these things. It doesn't really help in the long run. But I do wonder if and when the day comes that there's a zero, if I'm going to feel different. Or if I've just sort of learned to live with them. I mean, when I first got out of school, it really did affect me. I was terrified, and it shot my ego and my confidence down to zero, and I was terrified. I was scared. I was scared someone was going to come and knock on the door and take me away. And I actually didn't know that you couldn't go to debtor's prison for a while. Like, my mom told me, she's like, you know, like, no one's going to come and, like, take your stuff or anything. I'm like, well, they could garnish my wages. I'm like, she's like, yeah, but... It's going to take a while. You're not alone. It's going to be okay. And then through a lot of just like, you know, denial, you just move on and figure out your day. You can't let it tear you down.
Stupid loans. Anyway.
Anyway, let's not talk about
that. Let's not talk about that anymore.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
Do you have any artistic mentors that have been important to you over your career?
That's a good question. You know, the people who come to mind are my contemporaries, are my friends. Right now, I look at Arian Moyet as a real mentor. He is an actor who I understudied in The Humans. He's a wonderful, kind, generous Iranian man who is a year older than me. He's 39. I don't know if he knows this, and interestingly, when I first met him, I really didn't like him. In fact, some of my best friends in the world, when I first meet them, I hate them. Rami Malek, when I first saw him at Evansville, I was like, don't want to be friends with that cocky asshole. There's no way. And then, strangely, they end up becoming some of my closest friends.
That's interesting.
That's an odd thing. Arian is so incredibly ambitious and so incredibly hardworking. He does not stop. He's got his company, Waterwell. He's constantly creating events. He's constantly doing socially conscious work. He doesn't sleep, which I think helps. Like, he really only can, he can like make it on 3 or 4 hours of sleep.
Oh my God.
And it's constantly impressive to me at just how hard he works and how ambitious he is and how he supports his family and stays so positive. And to some people, I think it's off-putting because he's just so selflessly himself, if that makes sense. He's just what you see is what you get. But it comes from, I think, the fact that he's from Iran, or his family's from Iran, and being an immigrant, he's always had to feel like he has to work harder than anyone else. And, you know, being a white male, you don't really grow up with that push. You're like, you're kind of invisible, and you can kind of just skate by on a lot of things. So currently right now, he's someone who I really look up to because of his constant ambition. And other contemporary, I find I get so much just out of talking to my friends recently. I've learned a lot watching everything that's happened to Rami. Mm-hmm. And it's been fascinating. You know, you never really think that your best friend is going to have this crazy path and this crazy career and win every award and win the Oscar. And so that has just been a fascinating thing to watch happen. And I'm so proud and happy for him. And it really couldn't happen to a better person. He's incredibly humble throughout the process. But, you know, walking down the street with him now is fascinating because he's lost his anonymity. And right. When you lose your privacy, it's just like, well, what else do you have?
Yeah, what does that do?
Yeah. But I've learned a lot about the business as opposed to the art form from him, which mm-hmm. is such an important thing. And I think from both of those guys, watching them say no so much has been something that I never, you know, everyone's, you know, even acting teachers, it's just like, just say yes, just say yes. And so you're ingrained with this idea that you can never turn things down. But there's so much power in no, and there's so much, and I'm still learning it. But that's something that I found has been really helpful, is just to remember that people will come back around if you say no. Trying to think of other artistic mentors. I would also throw Reed Burney in there. His mentorship has been interesting because we're sort of on a break with our friendship right now. Mm-hmm. Not because of me, but for his own reasonings, he's needing to step away from a group of friends that were reminding him of a sore spot with a certain show that he was part of. But his mentorship has come in, I want to say, I don't think he's going to be listening to this, and even if he is, then I would say this to his face. His hatred for the business and for the people who have stepped on him. And I would listen to him talk about all these people who have wronged him and all these people who have, he's soured to over the years, and all these wonderful people he's worked with. And I find Reed to be just the most wonderful, sweet, generous, kind person who's just this extraordinary actor who I loved. I got to do The Humans with him in Los Angeles last summer, and it was just a joy to work with him. It was like one of those actors who you look at and you can't help but be really good and really truthful because they just are so good and they bring it out of you. It was such a joy to have that feeling every night. You're like, oh, I don't have to do any work. I just have to look in that person's eyes and they make me good. But his disgust of the industry, I've learned that I never want to feel that way. I want to be able to continue to practice gratitude even with all the challenges that this brings. I never want to sour mm-hmm. and be bitter, because there's just no time for that. There's no time for it. And why would you do this if it brings you so much disgust and angst? Now, what I have learned is that there's a lot of artists out there who thrive on that. It drives them. You know, it's like those couples who fight. And they're like, I'm like, oh my God, I could, you know.
But it's just the way that they communicate.
It's the way they communicate. Yeah. They yell. You know, if I were to raise my voice like this, talking to Ashley, she'd say, don't yell. And I'm like, well, that's hold on.
Frankie and I kind of make that as a joke now.
Oh, right.
Like, because yeah. We're like, don't yell at me.
Right. And I'm like, whoa. This is not yelling. And it's a little foreign to me because I grew up yelling with my family. We yelled. We fought. But it's actually really great because you have to figure out how to be clear and kind and succinct with what you're about to say without getting upset. It's been great. But some people need it. Some people like to yell. Some people like to fight. And some people, I think, the bitterness and the disgust drives them as an artist.
And this business makes it easy because of all the rejection and everything. I think
right.
it makes it very easy to fall into that trap.
Right.
Because it makes you feel active. It's like you're doing something.
Oh, by Even by railing against it?
Right. Even when you feel like you don't have anything else to control.
Right.
It makes you feel like you're doing something.
Right. Right.
Very dangerous.
But the rejection, I find, I feel like I've gotten to a really zen place with it, to be honest. Because it's happened so much that I really no longer take it personally. I've really found that I'll, you know, put all my eggs in one basket, think something went really well, and it doesn't happen. And I've really been able to be like, okay. And you just go. You just go on. Because there's just no point in, like, you didn't get the part, so there's nothing else to be done about it, right? You just have to move on. And I've been sort of surprised at how easy it's been to just keep going.
Was that a gradual process for you, or was there something where it finally clicked and you were like, you know what? I'm okay with this.
Well, I think it's because I grew up in high school and in college. I never was a blue chip. Like, I never had a paved path of success. Like, from the beginning, I was losing parts. So I think I just got used to it really early. I never really expected to get the lead. And, you know, in college, for example, when we did Othello, and you played Desdemona, I played Iago.
Yeah.
The reason I played Iago, yes, was because, like, I was good at that part, but also because junior year, sophomore year, I worked my ass off to show that I really wanted it. I was, like, head of paint. I did sound design. Like, I did all these things to try and be like, yo, give me a part now. I'm ready. And I want it, and I can work hard for it. So in some ways, I felt like I got that because, like, I worked for it in a way. Mm. And it also was at the very end of school. You know, it wasn't like I got great roles before that. I got cast.
Right, that was your senior year.
But that was my senior year. That was my big thing. And some people didn't get anything. You know, Rami went 3 or 4 years of Evansville and never got a good part. I mean, you got a decent part sophomore year, but you should have him on your show and ask him about Evansville.
I haven't seen him in years, and I would love to catch up with him.
Oh, he'd happily, I think, come do this. But, you know, he has some bitterness when it comes to Evansville.
I'm sure
he feels like his education came from being on set and working. And it's interesting how Evansville has now really wanted to cash in on everything that's happened there. He's like, yo, you're giving... He was given an award at Evansville, and he called them and said, what are you going to say? Because I wasn't in anything. You know, I was in studio shows. And
right.
You never really gave me a shot. A microcosm of the industry at the time, I suppose.
But that's a longer conversation.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Thanks for keeping us on track.
No,
you're a very good host.
Is there anything that you've learned about auditioning in kind of the last couple of years that you feel has changed the way you approach it as you've gotten farther away from grad school and everything?
Mm. I'm someone who always has to be off book to act.
Yes.
So I find that I still need to memorize my lines in this way. That is where I know them back and forth so that I can play in the room. I have been auditioning for more TV and film recently, which is such a different beast. And I feel such freedom when I'm auditioning for plays. And I feel such freedom being able to make choices and use the space. And I really sort of feel like I'm a king in the room when I audition for a play. I just know what I'm doing. And I don't know if that's just comfort on being on the stage, but recently I think with auditioning for TV and film, I've started to realize that it's less about my lines and more about being open to affect and really opening myself up to like how I'm feeling, slowing down, really listening and knowing too that even though it is about, you know, how do you feel, showing how you feel, that you are, especially for the roles that I'm auditioning for, which are, you know, large co-stars and guest stars, it's not like these long character arcs. You are a cog in a in a wheel, or, you know, whatever that expression is. you're fulfilling exposition and story. And so you have to just do that and not think that it's your big moment to, like, show your Oscar-winning tears.
Right.
That you just have to tell that story. And so in some ways it's become a lot simpler. But auditioning for TV and film is always, it took me a long time to get comfortable doing that. Something about it, I felt very stiff and nervous and afraid. And the more that I've combined the way I feel in the room auditioning for theater and trusting that I don't necessarily have to be really small, I can really still like trust my choices and audition in the same way for TV and film that I do for theater, the more success I've had. And really owning it too. I think the last thing I booked for a really like intense and scary casting director that people always talk about, Mark Sachs, who's actually lovely and wonderful. He's just a sweet person, but sometimes in the room, he'll do this thing where he'd be like, "Hi, Nick, you ready? Okay, great, action." And you're like, "What?" Okay. And I knew that going in. He's like, "Have a seat." And I'm like, "I'm actually gonna stand." He goes, "Really? Okay." This way of like, "Well, you're not gonna get this part." But I was like, "No, this is my space. This is my time." And I always love this quote that Billy Crudup said. It's like, when you audition, it's your one guaranteed time that you're playing the part. So how are you going to do it?
Yeah.
And the more and more I just sort of trust that, the better I feel. I also, too, since I was a kid, since I was 12 years old, I would say 9 times out of 10, I know if I got the part or not when I walk out of the room. I knew it, like... You just have a sense, I think, when the air moves, how they react. You know when you're really good. Like sometimes I've walked out and been like, "Ugh, that was bad," and then I got it. But those are few and far between. Most of the time, I leave, and if I don't get a call, and I feel good about it, and I don't get a call, I'm surprised. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's cocky or just how my process has been, but. Something comes over. It's like that thing when you're acting where you know you're completely going after your objective and doing everything right. You're sort of like standing on the head of a needle. And if you go too far forward after what you want, you fall off. If you're too vulnerable and open to affect, then you fall backwards. And you're just in that sort of strange zone, almost like an athlete, where you just can't miss. And time slows down, and you're just good. And it doesn't happen very often. But when it does, and especially in an audition room, then usually you book it, you know?
We don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, but how has it been for you and Ashley, since you're both artists, like navigating that in your relationship, how you support each other and how you balance, you know, the demands when one of you has an opportunity to work versus when the other one does?
Well, the wonderful thing about Ashley is that when we met, she cast me. That's how we met. I got this email right after.
She's primarily a producer.
Well,
now.
I would say primarily now she's an entrepreneur. She runs Vineyard Arts Project, and she started that when she was 19.
Oh, my God.
And has been running it for 10 years, and now it essentially just runs itself. The public comes up. Ars Nova comes up. All these incredible dance companies come up. It's an incredible organization on Martha's Vineyard that where they workshop new pieces in dance and theater. Just incredible setting. And so right when I moved back from Los Angeles, I got this email from an artistic director that said, "Someone has dropped out of this reading. Can you come up to Martha's Vineyard on Monday?" I think it was a Friday. I was like, "Yeah, sure." I expected this 50-year-old woman to be there. And it was Ashley picking me up in the parking lot. And I was with someone else at the time, and I think she was as well, so it was really easy to become friends. It was like one of those people that you meet, you're like, "Oh man, if I was single, I'd totally be after this person." But we're with other people, so we can flirt, and it's safe, and it's fine. We got to know each other, and we were friends for 2 years. And so the wonderful thing about that is that, you know, she's not a civilian. She is an artist, and she gets it. She gets the world. And since we had children, she has become incredibly passionate about breastfeeding. And even after producing a very successful off-Broadway play and having investments in Broadway plays and essentially thinking that she was a producer and that's what she wanted to do, she's made a complete 180 and now has started this clothing line for breastfeeding mothers. Chic, efficient, sexy clothing. It's called Madri Collection. And it really took off. They got a great shout out in Vogue right after they launched.
That's beautiful.
Beautiful article.
And she's done this like immediately after having children.
Exactly, yeah. And it's sort of this funny thing.
Incredible to me.
Yeah, it's sort of this funny thing too, where like now she has two companies, and you know, it's an odd thing when you wake up one day and your partner's like, "Oh, I actually don't want to be a producer anymore. Or I, if I do, I want to do it maybe another time. But right now I want to do this other thing. And you sort of go, okay, great. And so what's great about that is that, you know, when you get an email and it says, can you be in this reading tomorrow? And you're going to be gone all day. She says, yeah, go do it. This is important. And the highs are really high when you're working. And then she also understands when the lows are really low. But it is difficult to navigate, I think, in any relationship being an artist, just because there's so little control. I have so little control over if and when I'm going to work again. I know I will somewhere deep down, but I don't know when it's going to be, and I don't know how it's going to be, and I don't know if it's going to take me out of town or how much money it's going to be. And she's very accepting and very supportive of all that. And I think handles it way better than me. I have a tendency to get dark and down and depressed, and she's not like that. She's very even-keeled and stays very, you know, just she's a very happy person, I would say. And we were just talking about this last night. There's been a shift in us recently in our relationship because we're always good. I feel really lucky because we can't stay mad. Like, we can't go to bed angry. We have to talk it out before we fall asleep. We're just a couple that has to communicate. And when I was going a month or so ago, when I was just having like several days in a row of just being really sad and really down, I realized that I was like, there's only so long that you can just mope around because things aren't going your way. If anything, I just need to start supporting her because she's an artist, right? And we're together. And so in the same way that she was like, look, you need to figure out this debt thing because it's my debt too, legally. Now that we're married. And I was like, so like Madri Collection, her company, is also in some way mine. And so yesterday when we're doing a photo shoot to get one for her new dress that she created, you know, this is, we're supporting each other's endeavors together. Yeah. And so that actually, it's freeing in a way.
Yeah.
Because it's not just about me. It's about us as a whole. And both of us have such strange jobs that allow us to be home all day with these beautiful children, which at times we rail against, thinking, oh, we're missing out, we should be doing something, we should be out. But then you hear about these other situations where you have to work all day.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you guys were over last weekend or 2 weeks ago and you were saying that, I was like, oh,
the grass is always greener.
Grass is always greener. Right. So I feel really, really lucky and really grateful to have someone who understands this business and understands the highs and the lows of it. And she's constantly pushing me to not wait around and to say, okay, well, if you're dissatisfied with the lack of control, then let's look into maybe some sort of longer sustainable teaching job, or, you know, this seems to make you really happy and it's not involved in, maybe we can work towards that. Because I think you would agree that most of the jobs you end up booking, it's not because your agent just picks up the phone and is like, hey, I found something for you. You know, it's just like you usually get the job yourself. It's because someone you know, or you call them and you say, hey, I've got something here that I figured out. And they're like, oh, okay, great.
Give me 10%.
Yeah, exactly. But so, I'm incredibly grateful for how lucky I am to have to be with her. And it's just so interesting too, because, you know, like I said, we were friends for so long and I had this crush on her, and she was like, no, there's no way. And we were watching this movie last night on Netflix, Always Be My Maybe.
I just watched it,
which is
this
wonderful.
Week. It was so good.
We loved it. And there was some line in the movie about taking a chance. I'm like, I'm so glad I took a chance on me. And I said to her when we were watching last night, I'm like, I'm so glad you took a chance on me.
Aww.
Look how it worked. Look how it turned out. Like, we're good. So yeah.
We've got a strong team.
Yeah, we definitely have a strong team, which is good. Which is good. And we're so in the weeds right now and so underwater.
My God, two tiny children.
We had this wonderful experience because we wanted a baby right away. And so we started trying right after we got married and we got a baby. And then I look at it in this really wonderful way, because we got a baby, and then a year later, we were completely shell-shocked and surprised. Completely unexpected, complete accident. I mean, not an accident, Marlo, but totally glad you're here. But I love having that, both of those experiences. Like, I really wanted it, and I was totally surprised. And now I know exactly what both of those things feel like. And now I couldn't imagine it any other way.
Right. Like,
he was meant to be.
When you're teaching, what kind of teaching is it usually? What are we talking about for adults or kids? Or
most of my experience, I think, comes teaching kids. I'm a sub at Waterwell for the Professional Performing Arts School. I've taught at Rosie's Theater Kids. I volunteer at the 52nd Street Project, which is incredible. I find I've always loved kids, and I really enjoy teaching acting to kids. However, I think I would be more fulfilled by it teaching to a, like an older set of kids. When I get to sub for like the seniors at Waterwell in high school, I really, really enjoy working with a higher caliber of actor. Because sometimes when you're teaching acting to seventh graders or sixth graders, it's kind of like babysitting. And I love teaching. I think it's I'm quite fulfilled by it, and it also makes you a better actor because you're telling these kids to do all these things, and you're like, oh wait, am I doing all these things? Do I do all these things too? And I feel too though that I, in some ways as a teacher, I've kind of plateaued. Like I'm going over the same exercises again, saying the same things, starting to realize, okay, I actually need to maybe go and observe some class.
Yeah.
And go back. And NYU allows you to do that anytime. You can always come back and observe. And I'm like, maybe I just need to get back into it a little bit. And it's sort of this funny thing that kids do, too, to make you think, like, you're never going to work again. Or, like, especially in the first year, you're thinking, like, oh, I'm missing out on so much. And then you forget that, like, oh, eventually they're going to go to school. And you're going to get all this time back. And then what are you going to do?
Right.
You're going to have your days free again. And so you're going to have to figure that out.
Right. You can't stop your own self-development just because you're so invested in theirs.
Right. Exactly. Yes. That's really
well
said.
Which is very hard to remember right now.
Yeah. But right now is the time to be invested in theirs.
Yeah.
You know, they say the first 5 years is really instrumental in their development. Ashley's one who admittedly likes to be the boss. She wants to be the boss. She doesn't want to work for anyone. I would like to be the boss as well, but the nature of our business doesn't really allow that. There's so many other people that are in control besides us.
Right.
And I guess the deal with the devil that we make is that we get all the glory, you know, being, you know, in the limelight.
The face of the project.
Right, exactly.
So just two quick questions. When you are in that dark place, are there any like tangible things that you reach for again and again, like a book you reread or music you listen to or something like that? I know we talked about running.
Mostly what I do is look at it, instead of thinking about what I'm lacking, is looking around in the things that I have in a really basic way. Something as simple as like, dude, you live in New York City. You moved from Indiana to New York City. You said you were going to do it and you did it. And so I just sort of kind of go down the checklist. It's things as simple as like water.
Mm-hmm.
And really basic things that I take for granted. I mean, and especially now with where I live compared to even, you know, 5 years ago, you know. And I try and get really simple with it, about just first world problems kind of situation.
Yeah.
That usually tends to snap me out of it for a little bit. And also, you know, being single is really hard. And I was single for a long time. And so I have a lot of gratitude for just, and for feeling, I just feel really lucky that I found my mate.
Yeah.
Because it's just hard to be on your own. And I knew that I wasn't going to find the person that I was supposed to be with until I was able to love myself enough to just be alone. So when I got to that point, when I was like, actually, you know what? I really love myself. And I'm like really okay with being on my own. And that's when I met Ashley. And so I know in hindsight, obviously in retrospect, that I had to get to that place to be open to that opportunity of finding her. But at the end of the day, it really hits me, even on a sad day. And right now I'm sleeping on the couch because I have to get up really early with Ava and she's up all night with Marlo. Yeah. But it's usually at the end of the day when I spoon her that I go, oh God, I have everything. I have it all. Yeah. And that's what sort of jogs me out of my memory or out of the dark place. Like, I have this person, thank God. You know.
Thank God.
Yeah. Cuddling is good.
Cuddling is the answer to most things. The last question is, have you seen anything recently of any art form that you want to recommend?
Sure. Sure. What the Constitution Means to Me really, really did it for me. That was incredible. I like to always be my maybe. That was lovely. Let me think.
I know, they don't make enough like classic romantic comedies anymore.
I know.
I was so pleased watching it. I know. I love this.
I know. What was this other romantic comedy that we recently watched with Rebel Wilson where she's like, isn't it romantic?
I haven't seen it, but I remember when it came out.
That was fun. That was lovely. We really enjoyed watching that. This documentary that I'm blanking on the name of about all of the women that were running for Congress on Netflix.
I haven't seen that yet.
What is that called? It's with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Did I say that name right? I did. And that is something that I'm always trying to feel. You know, I think as artists, we're always usually very politically engaged as well in terms of trying to be more involved in our community. And it's something that I'm always beating myself up about because I'm like, oh, I just don't have enough time to like march or volunteer. And it's such bullshit. Like, there's so many ways to be active. And that was like a film that really made me realize, okay, I can do this. I can step up. And if there's any silver lining of this current administration, it's that it's driven people to act and driven people to get involved. Yes, and that's great.
Knock Down the House.
Knock Down the House, yes. That's it, yes. And I heard someone say something recently, which I think is really wonderful and important. Oh, it was the playwright, Claudia Rankine, of The White Card and Citizen. She said, I'm really afraid that if a Democrat gets in the White House in 2020, that everyone's going to think everything is back to normal. Mm. And we just, and everyone's going to go, oh, so sweet, it's over. It's over. And it's not. This is like clearly lifted a Band-Aid. We live in a very strange country with a lot, it's very big. And there's a lot of different people who have different ideas about how it's supposed to be run. And clearly, we're not all going to agree, but I feel like there's some certain moral issues that have to be ironed out and have to be figured out. And fortunately, I think the younger generation is on our team, but it doesn't mean that we can stop working. And I'm talking to myself right now.
Yeah.
I'm excited, in fact, once I come up for a little air, to be able to start getting more involved. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier about just giving. Giving is such a selfish, or it's just, it feeds the soul in such a good way. Anytime I go to 52nd Street Project, I walk out of there feeling amazing. And oddly enough, I find that anytime you do that, it brings, the universe rewards you in this way.
You just get the focus karmically off of yourself.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. We're so much focus on our own self, you know, like, how am I today, you know? And then the second you give it to someone, you know, try to help someone else, you're like, oh, this is so much easier, so much more rewarding, and so much more fun. So,
well, that's a great place to end.
I would agree.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you, Leah.
This is awesome.
It's an honor.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. If you find these conversations valuable to your life as an artist and would like to support the ongoing production of The Compass, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/thecompasspodcast. Pledges start at as little as $1 a month. You'll get access to bonus content, and anything you can give would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you have a moment, please rate or review in iTunes. Every little bit helps other listeners to find the podcast. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.